So I think for me and my brain and the way it's kind of worked over time is getting really stuck and kind of trapped in what was going to make me successful. This thing is going to make me successful. If I do this thing, it's going to make me successful. If I have this person around me, I have this thing. And then finding the limits of that and going like, okay, that was all my eggs in that one basket, right? So I think the value in being, you know, mentored is having somebody or multiple people who can help you dial in your process and help you kind of dial in those things that are helpful to you and help filter out the things that aren't helpful to you. And that includes pressure and that includes the support from an individual of like, okay, you need me to push you right now, or you need me not to.
That's three-time cyclocross national champion Stephen Hyde reflecting on the role mentorship has played in his life as an athlete. His unconventional path led him to the top of many podiums over the course of his career, and he now imparts his hard-earned wisdom to the athletes he coaches. In our conversation, Stephen shares his best advice for anyone still racing, why there's an inside of tape Stephen and an outside of tape Stephen, and why it's important and more effective to lead with your heart. You're listening to the Be a Good Wheel podcast, the show where we explore what it means to be a good wheel by digging into scientific research and personal stories about human potential and performance. I'm your host, Amber Pierce. Today, we get to hear from the remarkable Stephen Hyde, whose story is as inspiring as it is unconventional. Stephen's journey in cycling has spanned BMX, mountain biking, road racing, and of course, the gritty technical terrain of cyclocross. What sets Stephen apart is not just his athletic prowess, but the unique path he carved. Stephen entered the sport later than most pros, and despite defying more traditional paths, he nonetheless achieved results most of us only dream about. Growing up, Hyde was a fixture on the BMX tracks in his hometown of Pensacola, Florida, spending endless hours riding until dusk. While his talent took him to races across the country, his focus remained primarily on the fun of it. That connection he found on the bike would take many forms over the years, from working as a bike mechanic to racing mountain bikes to riding across the country. He eventually got into the cycling disciplines of cyclocross and road, and it was clear he had real talent. Recognizing his potential, friends and mentors connected him with the Jam Fund team, where he quickly earned a spot on the roster. The Jam Fund is a holistic program established to help athletes cultivate their potential and reach the pro ranks. The team and coaches offered Stephen the support he needed to take his talent to the next level. He would go on to build an outstanding career racing professionally on the road, as well as becoming a legend in his own right in cyclocross. In cyclocross, he won 3 national championship titles, 2 Pan American championships, and competed in 4 world championships. But his story is as filled with setbacks as it is with life-changing results. He has battled serious illness and multiple injuries and has been open about his struggles with depression and mental health. Through it all, Stephen embraced the support of his community, learning how to prioritize mental well-being amidst the rigors of competition and how to work toward balance in his own process. Stephen's story is also a testament to the transformative power of mentorship. Guided by mentors and becoming a mentor himself, Stephen has found belonging and community in cycling. He now pays that forward as a coach, and we get to hear from him about what he's learned from those relationships and how he now applies those lessons. Join us as we explore the storied career of Stephen Hyde, a testament to resilience, camaraderie, and taking the path less traveled. Both Stephen and I were battling colds when we spoke, but we had a great conversation. I hope you enjoy it as much as we did. Today, I am so excited to welcome to the show 3-time cyclocross national champion, 2-time Pan American champion, Stephen Hyde. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
One of the phrases that's often been used to describe you is that you came out of nowhere, so to speak. But when I read about your history and I read your interviews, you were involved with cycling and bikes for a really long time before you actually got into racing. Would you agree with that statement that you came out of nowhere?
I still don't think I'm anywhere. So I think it might be wrong. Yeah, I don't know where I came from or where I'm going for that matter. Yeah, I mean, bikes have always been a really big part of my life. You know, whether I've had a trajectory in them or not, you know, in terms of racing is unclear to me, but I've always been in the presence of bikes, and just kind of, they've always kind of led me to where I wanted to go from, you know, from a kid to now, you know, still am still following them. So, we're using them as a tool to kind of carve out my life. And so in that way, I don't know. It's just always been bikes have always just been a tool to carve out the direction I wanted to go in, or that maybe the directions that opened up and then I followed them through. Whether I wanted to go there or not, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think the thing about with me and bike racing is that I found it. Like, you know, it wasn't something that when I was, you know, young, I was like, I'm going to be a bike racer, you know, or necessarily have the pathway to do that. So I think when the door opened up, I just kind of stepped in it, and, you know, both at the amateur level, stepped in and out of it. And then when it opened up at the professional level, it was just kind of the right time, right place. So I think for people in like the Northeast, or for people in the professional scene, especially cyclocross, sure, I didn't have a big run into it in terms of, like, you know, I never got to race any of the USGPs. I wasn't on like a youth development program or anything. I mean, racing cross when I was like, I don't know, 23 or 24 or something like that. So yeah, I guess I didn't have a traditional run in. So maybe that's where it comes from.
Yeah. Yeah. So for our audience who's less familiar with cycling, on the men's side of the sport in particular, there are a lot of youth development programs, especially through our national federation, USA Cycling, where they might identify, you know, I know when I was first getting started in the sport, there were things like talent identification camps, and there are U23 development programs. And so coming into the sport at age 24 is relatively late, given that other people who maybe come up through the quote unquote system are coming to the sport a little bit earlier and through a more structured path. And you didn't take that path. You were involved in bikes for a long time, and you started out in BMX. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I started out in BMX. I mean, I grew up in
going
a pretty
way back.
Small, yeah, going way back, you know, I grew up in a pretty rural, like, small town. And so, you know, I think even from as a little kid, you know, we were just bikes. I was on them all day long, you know, and definitely I was probably never the best at it, but I was always like the last one on the bike at the end of the day, you know? And it just, you know, happened to kind of follow along with my friend circle in terms of who was doing BMX, and I kind of came to it naturally through that.
So was that what first drew you to it, that your friends were doing BMX?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I had a bunch of older brothers and stuff, and there was a few that were into it, and they had some friends, so I was like, yeah, this is cool. And I think I was always into exploring the limits of whatever I was doing. So BMX was a really interesting way to take bikes and explore the limits of it, or, you know, of myself with it. And I think that's kind of my, like, spirit anyways, if you will.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was an easy thing for me to just kind of use up a bunch of energy and also find my limitations and push myself to do that, you know, just kind of naturally.
Yeah. And eventually you went from BMX to mountain bike, road, and cyclocross. Mm-hmm. But that was also not a traditional nor linear path, right? It was, you were wrenching, you were bike touring.
Yeah. Yeah. All over the place, really. I mean, I just, you know, I got a job at a bike shop when I was in high school, and I ended up dropping out of high school, and just kind of, we lived in, you know, other people's cars and the back of my truck, and traveled around riding BMX all over the country, and then, you know, street, park, and stuff like that. And when I started working at a bike shop, it kind of opened up all these other different avenues. You know, I got my first mountain bike was out of a dumpster that I learned to, like, you know, build, and it was kind of my teaching tool. I got that up and running, and I used it actually for years. It was great. A little 26 inch Gary Fisher Tassajara. Literally out of
that's amazing
U-Haul dumpster that we had behind the bike shop. And
brilliant.
I was, you know, I was like riding fixed gears around. I was smoking cigarettes and going to punk shows and, you know, the whole thing. I was the epitome of health. But I think at that point I had, like, maybe even given up my vehicle, my truck, and started just using bikes as a commuting tool. And then, you know, through the bike shops, I was, in order to learn something, I need to do it. And I think kind of quite naturally, I figured out that I also need to teach it a little bit for me to learn it. I think it's just kind of always been in me to want to kind of externalize how I learn a little bit. And so it was pretty natural for me to being in the punk scene in Pensacola and like how kind of DIY and community interactive it was to just go like, oh, here's the thing that I have, you know, here's my talent. You know, I can share that with you guys. You know, you share music and you share art and, you know, here's, or books, you know, thoughts, and here's my, I can help with this. Everybody has a bike here, so I can help you fix it. And that was kind of an empowering thing for me to be a bigger part of the community rather than just being a bike rider, just being this or that. It was kind of a gift for me to be able to give and connect with other people. It was really fun. And so through that, just, you know, found mountain bikes and started riding them with the local club and found the trails. And then, you know, eventually somebody came in and was like, hey, should come ride with the road club, you know? And I started riding on my fixed gear and it was great. And then they were like, hey, you should come to the road races with us. And then, you know, eventually it was like Saturday jumping in the car with whoever was going to the road race. And then Sunday jumping in the car, whoever was going to the mountain bike race, and then coming back to the bike shop on Monday, you know? So it just kind of found its way into my like life cycle. And I was just so hooked. I had all this energy that I needed to get out, like this just perpetual energy. And bike racing was the high intensity portion of it that I think I really needed, you know?
You needed that outlet?
Yeah. Yeah. And being like a younger brother, you know, and the youngest in the neighborhood and all this stuff, I've always just been so competitive and like such a pain to everybody that it just transferred really nice to bike racing, where I was like, yeah, I'm going to annoy everybody here with my endless amounts of energy. Congratulations.
But it's also like this arena where that's exactly what you're meant to do, right? So it's this place where you can fully express that aspect of yourself in a way that is completely not only socially acceptable, but utterly expected, right? Like that's what you're there to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think that kind of like, you know, if anything, emboldened my passion for it. And, you know, somebody was just like, hey, the thing that you do that kind of drives people nuts a little bit and yourself nuts a little bit is actually a really good trait for this. You know, this is a great outlet for that. And actually, it's a little bit of your superpower, you know? And so, yeah, it was just a really natural progression for me to go to bike racing. And once I kind of get that, the proverbial bit in my teeth, I've never been able to pull up from it. And I still can't. You know, it's still really difficult for me to like, you know, I'm retired and I still can't like think about bikes in a relatively healthy way.
Oh man, yeah. I feel that. So I want to come back to the retirement piece for sure, because I think that's a really rich area to mine. But before we do that, I want to touch on a couple of points that you made that I think are really interesting, because you talk about coming to this from community and having something of genuine value to offer to the community, and something of value to offer that is just, well, two things, right? That you have things that you can teach. And then also when you come to the races, it's this opportunity to express your purest, most authentic self in an area where, yeah, that's what we do when we race. Would you say that cycling was a place where you really found belonging in your life?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It really is. I mean, it gave me a community. You know, I think people saw me and respected me and respected the things that I had to bring to the table. And it was an area where I could be challenged to work hard. You know, I think, you know, I'm a pretty dexterous person. You know, I think I pick up on things that need kind of thoughtfulness and finesse, dexterity to do them. And, you know, music has been one of them where like, I need to use my body a little bit. Right. And so I, however, have always reached a point with things where, okay, this is a little bit too hard. You know, now I'm getting beyond the threshold of my natural ability. And, you know, for a lot of things, I wasn't able to push beyond that, you know, whether it was, I didn't have the tools to do it, or I didn't have the support to do it, or I ignored the tools and the support to do it. not blaming anyone else but myself, but I think bike racing happened to be, I think, the culmination of all these different stimulus that I needed. And it just so happened that I think when I came out of nowhere, you know, air quotes, it really was the point in time where I met the right group of people who both believed in what I did, but also held me accountable to my kind of goals and aspirations, and really just kind of pushed me to say like, hey, yes, you have a talent for this. don't let it go. If this is something you want to do, work hard at it. You know, here, let me help you lay out a foundation and a future and help you stay accountable to it. And I also think that same group was able to kind of, through that process, like help me also harness those other things that I really love to do, you know, teaching. You know, my first cyclocross team that I was on, you know, the Jam Fund, I was also the mechanic for them, glued all the wheels. I taught people how to glue the wheels and, you know, with help from everyone else. And we kind of went through the process of like, I'd help people build up their own bikes and we'd maintain them during the week. And, you know, I was able to kind of both learn my craft and help other people learn their craft by proxy and through experimentation. And the same agency I was getting, you know, I was able to kind of help with too. So mentorship all of a sudden became this really crucial tool to keep me accountable in the sport that I wanted to be in. It was really cool. You know, that, yeah, that was just a really neat time in my life, I think.
Yeah. So was that what you're referring to? Is that when you kind of fell in with Jam Fund? Is that the community, the group of people that really...
Yeah. Yeah, it really was. Jam Fund, I mean, Al Donahue, Powers. I mean, that's where I met some of my, you know, really good friends that I still am just very lucky to have. Ellen Noble came through that. so, you know, we're still really close. And I mean, just a myriad of awesome people who went in different directions, you know, whether it was mm-hmm. like became stepping on world championship podiums or like are going into outer space now. Christina Birch, I mean, she was one of my teammates and she's a NASA astronaut now. And like,
oh my gosh,
right? It's like, it's so wild. You know, you, and even, you know, some kids that were really, really talented and didn't quite make it as far as they could have are still made a really big impact on my life. And I think through that program also continue to make impacts on other people.
Yeah.
And that program still going, you know, and I'm lucky to be right down the road from it and have at least be in the earshot of it.
Yeah. So you've mentioned a few times the aspect of teaching, and I want to get into that in a minute, but also sometimes it's not easy to be mentored and or to open yourself up to somebody who is stepping forward to say, hey, I really believe in you and I want to help you, and being open to accepting that help and support. Was that something that you struggled with, or did it come easily, or what was that like for you?
Still struggle with it.
You still struggle
yeah,
with it?
Yeah, I still struggle with it, for sure. I mean, you know, I think being in the hot seat can be really difficult. You know, some people thrive on mm-hmm. it, and some people flounder in it, and some people kind of like run the gamut back and forth. I think working with other people has helped give me an understanding of kind of the gives and takes of that, like how people react when they're pushed beyond what they're capable of dealing with, you know, how they react when they're not pushed. I draw from my own experiences of like, okay, so when did I withdraw? When did I feel like I had too much on my plate? Mm-hmm. Not too much support, but too much
right.
obligation, pressure. So I think the struggle for me always was finding a balance of pressure and support and mm-hmm. breaking down the kind of macros of what that support looked like from time to time. Like, it doesn't always look the same, right?
Right.
Having a coach that supports you and believes in you is really helpful. Sometimes that's the key to success, and sometimes, you know, it's just a small part of it. Sometimes it's your support network in terms of, you know, your team or your equipment or whatever it may be. So I think for me and my brain and the way it's kind of worked over time is getting really stuck and kind of trapped in what was going to make me successful. This thing is going to make me successful. If I do this thing, it's going to make me successful. If I have this person around me, I have this thing. And then finding the limits of that and going like, okay, that was all my eggs in that one basket, right? So I think the value in being, you know, mentored is having somebody or multiple people who can help you dial in your process and help you kind of dial in those things that are helpful to you and help filter out the things that aren't helpful to you. And that includes pressure, and that includes the support from an individual of like, okay, you need me to push you right now, or you need me not to.
Yeah.
It's a learning relationship always. And so you learn that with your mentors and you learn that with your mentees. And I think it's a bit of an outlet for me to be able to kind of mentor other people. It takes a little bit of pressure off of me in a way where like I can take some of that tension and expectation on me and not pass it to someone else, but help them deal with it. And in that way, it's a little bit therapeutic for me.
Yeah.
Whether that's a good or a bad thing, right? Like, I think that it runs the gamut a little bit in terms of that could be bad in the way where, okay, so if I'm ramping up and my anxiety is, then I'm ramping up my need to do that to someone else. And they might not need that at the time, you know, thinking about a teammate.
Yeah.
Or something like that, where I'm just kind of vomiting advice to them and they're just like, I don't need this.
But wait, I need some therapy right now, so I need to be able to tell you what to do. Yeah. I can relate to that. I think when I first started racing and I could still call myself a rookie, I'll say, I think I had this idea in my head that everybody who was really good at the sport was also just like really good on their own, and that somehow I should be able to do this myself and I should be self-sufficient and I shouldn't need that kind of support from people. And it wasn't really until I was in a position to be a mentor that I realized what a joy it is to mentor and how much I actually learned and felt fulfilled in that role, and how as a mentee, as somebody being mentored, you actually give that gift to the person mentoring you. Like, you give somebody the opportunity to have that outlet to help them process and learn even what they're going through themselves. And I think it wasn't until I was in a position to be a mentor and see the value in that role that I was able to, I don't know, feel less guilty about accepting or seeking support from people.
That makes total sense. I have a question for you.
Yes.
When you started your kind of mentorship journey, did it help you in your process of failing, your own failing?
100%. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, feel that.
Big time, because when I would see somebody that I was mentoring struggling or, you know, failing to meet a goal or what, you know, whatever we want to call that failure, that setback, from the outside looking in, it was so easy as the mentor to see the bigger picture and to know that, oh, this is just a setback and let's see what we can learn from this. And all of a sudden I'm going, this is not what I say to myself in my head when I fail.
Yeah, it's wild how that, you know, just how much of a mirror it can be, you know?
Yes, that's exactly it. It reflects back to you so clearly and powerfully. You can't escape it. You can't deny it.
That is true. That is so true. Yeah, yeah. Good. Because I think it's a wonderful experience. And I coach now, I mean, full time. And again, it's just kind of this natural progression for me. And part of what I really like about it is I coach a few athletes that also have athletes of their own. And it's so much fun to me to listen to them and to listen to how they interact, you know, how they coach. I like working as a collaboration as much as anything. You know, it's okay, cool. I'm going to learn as much from you as I hope that you learn from me. And, you know, I've met other coaches and seen this scenario play out where, okay, I won't coach you if you coach other people. You know, you're not going to take my trade secrets here, you know, and even with coaching companies, yeah. So like you can't coach if you are one of our athletes.
Yeah.
But I think it's just super cool because you all of a sudden, you're not just having an effect on one person. You're having an effect on one person that has an effect on, say, 10 people. And it's this echo where if you can add something positive, if you can just give them an understanding of failing gracefully and how to kind of interact with that, then they get to do that with their other athletes. And just inadvertently, you're like this, you have this impact beyond what you thought. And so it's I don't know. Worth bringing up. I thought it was really cool. Kind of a realization I've had pretty recently.
That's so true. And I think that that's true for most of the things that we do. But in that scenario, you see it really quickly and you can see it concretely and with a lot of immediacy, right? Like, it's not just, oh, hypothetically, I may have done something that had a positive impact on one person and that may have hypothetically impacted other people.
Right.
We know that that's true.
Yeah.
But those are the stories that we often don't get to see play out. But in your in this case, you actually get to see it play out and talk about it and be in it and reflect on it. That's
it's super cool.
So powerful.
Yeah, it's so much fun. I mean, sometimes the coaching conversations aren't even about them. It's we spend an hour talking about how they can kind of use these tools for other people, and then I don't even have to say it to them directly. They just do it without, you know, it's like, hey, do this with your, you know, if you want to connect with your athletes, like try this, you know, what if you listened in this way, you know, what if you used what they were telling you to push them in this direction, to help them find this thing. And then something clicks in their head and they're like, oh yeah, cool.
Yeah.
So I got it today. I got it this week. We're good.
I love this. Well, my follow-up question was going to be, all right, you know, what are we like talking about the art of being mentored? But then I wanted to follow up and ask you about the art of mentorship. And I mean, we're already there and you're in this role now as a coach and there's a lot of experience to draw on. We could talk about your experience as a pro athlete or even before that when you were, you know, doing clinics for co-ops and community shops. How did your experiences sort of feed into this? Because it seems like you've really gravitated to this role. And from the outside looking in, it seemed that you were already mentoring people in the sport, even as you were racing yourself. Is it something that you've already that you've always been drawn to, or do you think that this was something that your early experiences sort of shaped in you?
That's interesting. I would say that I think in terms of how I learn best, externalizing and practicing and trying to connect dots, you know, beyond simple instruction is really helpful for me. And so I think that throughout my whole like life, starting at some point, and I think especially with the bikes, I think it was just kind of the ticket for me. It really has just been a process of me learning.
Yeah.
Me teaching is just regurgitating what I know.
It's an extension of the learning process.
And it helps me, okay, did I get that right? It gives me confidence to say that, like, I know it. If I could tell somebody how to do this, or if I could help them do this, it gives me the confidence to know, it gives me the confirmation to know that this is good. I've got my confirmation here. This is solid. I think what it has also done for me beyond anything else is help me develop relationships with people and help me develop the tools and pathways to develop relationships with people. Because you don't teach something by saying, here's how you do it. Right? You could. I mean, that's how the public school system does it, right? I think that, you know, there's a way. And some people respond to that and some people don't respond to that. And I think the reality is that in order to mentor, in order to teach anything, there's a psychological component to it. There's a connection to the person whom you're teaching. You're not teaching a subject, you're teaching a person the subject.
Yeah.
And so I think for me, as like a very social individual, it helped me develop my social aptitude, you know, my like the vernacular I use of people and how I interact in terms of when I listen, when I talk. I'm a talker. I'm a voracious talker. And so like I had to learn at some point and still have to learn better to listen and to draw out the thought process and the questions from other people. And so I think through the years of whether it was doing clinics or, you know, working with athletes, working with teams, my process has always been, how do I extract information from a person? You see very clearly results. You see very clearly when someone translates theory or a concept onto the bike. I guess what I really like about cyclocross too is that like it's so nuanced. It takes a very well developed ability to translate concept into motion, and you're fighting all these odds with like the bike and the conditions and yourself, competition. The bike is really not meant for this. Like it's really not. It's really dumb that you're doing it. And it's, you have to learn where the consequences are to that, right? And so I think for me, just emotionally, being able to translate my emotions and my thoughts and my wants and needs and desires into usable words and phrases, coaching has been a process, or mentorship and teaching has been a process for me to kind of develop that language.
Mm-hmm.
Through that, it's been a process of me developing a process in which to get that language from other people and translate it back into my head and then down into the bike, right? So it's kind of this back and forth process constantly of communication.
Yeah.
It's really fun when you look at it that way. I mean, at least it is for me. You know, it's like this challenge constantly of just like, did what I just say, did it go through? Like, did it reach them?
Right.
Is it going to translate? How do I redo it?
Yeah.
You know, how can I now meet this person kind of where they're at to reach the goal that we want?
Well, this is, I mean, it's the crux of connection, period, right? Is
totally
to understand that what you intend to say may not be what actually lands, and that what really matters is what actually lands and how that impacts the person who's receiving the information, and then vice versa, learning to understand that what you're hearing from the person speaking to you might not even be what they intend, and learning how to have that back and forth to create a genuine connection. That's so much more than teaching and bikes.
Absolutely. And I think here's the reality. And what I learned from bike racing over the years is that success doesn't come in a vacuum of trust. And I think thinking about all the, I don't know, directors and people that I've had to kind of answer to or listen to over the years, often my least successful times came when I didn't have trust in those people. And so I didn't have trust in those people because I didn't feel seen by those people. I didn't feel like they saw me as an individual who had these certain capabilities. They saw me as like, hey, you've won some bike races, go win this one. And that just never sat very well with me. And it was always really hard. And it made it really hard working on big teams where I was often on a road team with like people I just never even talked to, you know, like I never talked to some of them. And some I'm good friends with still, and some I barely ever spoke with. You know, we did week-long stage races, and I barely spoke to them.
Yeah.
And so my connection to them just was never strong. It still isn't. And those are the people, actually, those are the situations where I think about the most now, because I feel like I missed a connection there, right? Like, I missed an opportunity to grow. I missed an opportunity to perform in some way because I wasn't able to connect with those people. And for whatever reason, that haunts me much longer than anything else.
That's so interesting. I really relate to that. I can go back at moments in my career, too, where I feel like I could have gotten so much more, not only out of myself, but out of the situation and the experience. And not necessarily even in a selfish way, but also like if I had been connected and engaged on a deeper level, that I would have been able to contribute more. And that is kind of a hard pill to swallow. That is a tough...
But it's also, it's a two-way street, you know, and I think that's what you have to realize too, is that it's always a two-way street, you know, especially as an athlete, have so much expectation on you. You have so much riding on your shoulders that it's not necessarily always fair to put you as the athlete in the position to have to build these relationships beyond what's easy and accessible.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really difficult thing. And that's where good leadership comes from, I think, in a team, right? And where you see really good team bonding. You just see teams come and you're like, how do these people just slay it every time they show up? You know, and they're like hanging out or high five. You see them at the dinner table together, you know, and you're like, they're just, this is unbelievable. This is like unbeatable force, right? And that it's true because they have real connection, you know, and you see other teams floating around, not talking to each other on their phones, different little squads of people floating around. And that takes leadership to function.
Big time. And I've seen those teams, and I've been on teams that have that chemistry, and I've been on teams that don't. And the magic of it is when you have that chemistry, you find an extra 10, 20, 30%. Every single time. And you know that that's what's happening with all of your other teammates too. And you can trust that that's happening. And I agree that trust is a huge ingredient of that. But I'm recalling a moment where I remember a director that we were working with who had cultivated that kind of chemistry said, all right, you know, make sure that you guys go sign in as a team. And he said, there's nothing more intimidating than seeing an entire team rock up to sign in, laughing, relaxed, and having the best time together. And that really stuck with me because it's so true. Like, you kind of think about intimidation as being, you know, like the hard stare or the glare or the, you know, the really serious, intense face. No, it's the people that are super relaxed and having a great time that are the scariest.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because you're like, what do they know that I don't?
Yeah.
Like, I'm terrified of what's about to happen. Like, we're about to go to war here, and you guys are like laughing. Get out of here.
So tell me about, you mentioned the times where you didn't have that trust. What about when you did have the trust and you did have that leadership? What was that like?
It's fantastic. I mean, when you do have that trust, I mean, it goes such a long way. And I think what I found too, you know, I found my niche in cyclocross, right? And it's a very individualistic sport, very.
Yeah.
But I've also been on teams. I've always been on teams for cyclocross. And so you kind of run this like interesting dynamic, especially when you're like racing each other. I have been in multiple situations, you know, some where there's a situation of distrust, you know, where you're like, you're trying to kind of your competitors as well as teammates, but primarily competitors.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the world of, there's the different world of where your teammates first and competitors second. And I think for me, navigating that came a couple of different ways. When I didn't have the teammates necessarily that I could cultivate the trusting portion with, you know, I really relied on the staff that worked with the team. Mm. And I think this gave me a really, I think it gave me a wonderful insight into what makes a good, effective staff. You know, you can have the best mechanic in the world, but if you don't trust them, it's a energy suck to work with them. It's not good. You know, your team management can be fantastic, but if you just know they're never going to make the right choice for you, then like, it's just not a good fit. With your teammates, it can be a little bit different, right? Like, okay, we both just get paid to be here and to win races. One of us has to win this race. You know, that's the thing. It's like, we're here and one of us has to win this race. So we can be miserable all the time and just be fearing each other. Or we can use each other as a way to calm ourselves and to have solidarity, right? And I have always pushed myself, even when I didn't want to be more open and more giving with what I do know, my insights, or I'll tell somebody my tactics right away. Like, this is what I'm going to do today.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's never failed me because it's going to push me to be smarter. It's going to push me to go deeper when I need to. And it's going to push me to say like, okay, if I'm right now good as I can get, if I help this person who's second to me come up to my level and even challenge my level, well, then that's the push that I need. Like, that's fantastic. Yeah. That's a tool for me to use. And I think adopting that mindset early on was just super helpful because when I came to the sport, my immediate reaction was go find the better riders and then be their best friend, figure it out.
Yeah.
And then you move through that and then you're like, okay, cool. You know, we have this really great relationship and now I have this other person that's pushing me. And once you make those relationships, they always push you, whether it's results or not, they're always going to push you because they have different mindsets. They have different ways of going about things. It's always, you know, been helpful to me to have a different point of view. But when you run out of that progression, then it only made sense to me to try to build up people around me or to try to kind of form alliances where, you know, maybe they weren't my teammate, but I knew that they were going to be the person on the day that was going to be able to help me the most progress, you know, challenge me the most. There were a lot of days where like, so Powers, you know, Jeremy Powers was a really good example of this, like where he was my mentor at first and then became my biggest rival. And eventually we had to go from mentorship to rivalry. So we're rivals, but we're also like compatriots in a way. We train together. We are, you know, I'm on a development program or I came through that development program. We're trying to both do the same thing, but we're also trying to beat each other and like earn the same money, etc. So you kind of learn to like develop the two different relationships.
Mm-hmm.
One being a friendship. You know, I always say like, you need to be two different people as an athlete. You need to be inside of tape, Steven, and you need to be outside of tape, Steven.
Oh, that's a really good way of putting it.
Right, because you do. You really need these different personas. You need to interact differently in those two different worlds. And we can be best friends. Best friends. The moment we cross that line, we have a stated objective. And short of hurting each other, we should do everything to push, you know, our own agenda in that way. And there's plenty of times where maybe it was my teammate, Curtis, for example, Curtis White, where I'd say like, all right, dude, here's how we're going to work everyone over today. You know, like, what do you think? You know, can we do this? Like, and then once we whittle down, then we fight each other. Right. So let's get rid of everybody else and then do this. And there were times where it was like Powers and I, or Terry Werner or whatever outside of my tent where it was just like, all right, you're the best today. So how do we get just alone, shed everyone else, and then we race?
Right.
When you start thinking about your competitors in that way, and this totally goes for road too. And I tell this to athletes that are racing road races on their own. And they're like, oh, I can't beat a team. Like, dude, if you're just a one-person show on a race course, everybody's your teammate. You just need to kind of be there, but like get out of the way just a little bit, follow around. Everyone's your best friend.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, this makes so much sense. And it's interesting the way that you're articulating this, because I think it would be easy to characterize the competitiveness of top athletes as being a desire to beat everybody. And there's a really big difference between the will to win and the will to beat everybody. It's not that you, or not you, but when I talk to athletes who are at this level, and I felt this way too, it wasn't, yes, the winning is awesome, and that is absolutely a goal, and we love to win, but it's not about beating people. It's about seeking excellence. And if I'm going to figure out what my best looks like, I need a competitor there pushing me, because I can't do that by myself. I can push myself pretty hard in training, but I can never push myself as hard as I can when I'm in the arena pitted against a competitor. And so we become allies in that sense, because we're teaching each other. When a competitor bests me in a race, I've just learned something about my weaknesses and where I need to go back and work on myself as an athlete. And that helps me become better and closer to this greatness that I'm hoping to achieve. But it's a very different mindset than I want to go beat everybody.
Oh, 100%. I think when you let beating people be your prerogative, you're letting your ego rather than your heart drive what you want to do. And I think ego always loses, because ego lives alone. And in the end, like, beating people just isolates, and wanting to beat people, wanting to beat this, wanting to beat that will always isolate the person that ends up being on the other side of it. And so I think being a good competitor is letting your heart drive things, you know, letting like, how is this good for me? Because beating people isn't good for anybody. I mean, we see that with like war a lot of times. You just want to start a war and beat somebody down. Like, nothing comes from that.
Everybody loses.
Everybody loses. And so I don't know. I think you have a moral dilemma as an athlete that goes beyond. It really is who you are as a person, how you interact with your athletics. And I think that it's necessary to have that battle. I think that where good mentorship and good coaching comes in is helping an athlete develop that so that it transcends their athletics into their life. You know, and then they can start kind of looking at everything in that perspective of cooperation and community beyond any of that.
Yeah. Yeah. You can see competition as a cooperative effort, not just as this zero sum game. And when you do that, what that looks like is what you've been describing. Yes, you may be going out there and wanting to win the race, and you might be strategizing with your teammate or even competitors on how to make that happen. But your goal ultimately is to achieve whatever greatness is within you. And in order for you to do that, you need competitors who can push you. And therefore, your job is to not only learn from them, but teach them, because the more that you can teach them and get them better, the more they elevate your game. And it just becomes this really beautiful virtuous cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't be a competitive in a vacuum. It doesn't happen.
No. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We'll be back with more from Steven after this quick break. If you appreciate what we're doing and want to support the show, you can support us directly through Patreon and Ko-Fi. Both Ko-Fi and Patreon enable you to help us cover production costs through memberships with perks, like access to bonus episodes, merch, and more. We encourage you to check out our page on Ko-Fi, as they don't take a fee. You can find it at ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. That's ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. Unlike Ko-Fi, Patreon takes an 8% fee. That said, if you're already supporting other creators on Patreon, you can support us there too. Find us on Patreon at patreon.com/beagoodwheel. That's patreon.com/beagoodwheel. For even more ideas on how you can support the show, check out beagoodwheel.com/support. That's beagoodwheel.com/support. If the idea of being a good wheel resonates with you, check out the Be a Good Wheel community at beagoodwheel.com/community. The community is a virtual, membership-based organization of like-minded folks keen to continue exploring what it means to be a good wheel beyond the podcast. Connect with other folks on topics that go way beyond the bike, toward meaningful application and fellowship across industries and aspirations. Fuel your curiosity and inspiration by joining today. Learn more and join us at beagoodwheel.com/community. That's beagoodwheel.com/community. Oh, this is, yes, this really resonates. So, and this kind of, I mean, just to get super cheesy here for a minute, it definitely ties into the title of the podcast, the Be a Good Wheel podcast. And I, sure. I'm sure that there are more people that we can count out there who would cite you as being a good wheel in their lives. Is there somebody that stands out to you that was a good wheel for you that you want to just give a quick shout out? Doesn't it? I know there were probably lots. So we say this with the caveat that it's hard to pick one, but.
Yeah, it is hard to pick one. I mean, you know, I've been really lucky, I think, in my life to have Al Donahue, who still runs the Jam Fund program. He was my coach for years and years and years, and is still one of my best friends of all time. Did each other's weddings, and just he's the only person whom my 3-year-old has stayed over with, and then his wife Catherine. So, you know, still going strong in that arena.
That's big trust.
Big trust, yeah. You know, and there's just been so many. I mean, I'm really lucky to count so many more people as friends than not in the sport. Mm-hmm. I could count on one hand the people whom I don't have relationships still with in my career. I think it's a very, very small number of people. So I'm really, really lucky to both have racers, you know, coaches and mentors that I still really look up to and that I still call and need from time to time.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's success by any definition right there. I mean, big time.
Yeah. I feel so lucky in that way. And I think I have always kind of been reticent to, you know, do my own biography and, like, you know, especially when we're talking, you know, hey, introduce yourself, you know, whatever. Because, you know, I had a career where I won and lost bike races, but almost none of that matters to me in the slightest. It really is all the relationships that I built. And for anybody who's in their career right now, you know, the best advice I could possibly give them is, like, hey, just build relationships, because these are your friends. These are the people whom helped you do this, and they will more than likely help you way beyond bike racing, and you probably help them more than you know. And eventually, like, you might cheers to reminisce on your bike racing life or your athletic life and say, like, hey, remember that race? That was really cool. Or that win, whatever. But the thing you're more going to talk about are the experiences you had together rather than the wins. You know, those are just such fleeting, small parts of it.
Yeah. Yeah. When I think about the highlights of my career, I mean, the things that come to mind are the moments where, you know, a teammate collapses in my arms crying, or, you know, just those, like, those moments of, like, really deep connection and trust that, you know, sometimes they happen on the bike and often they happen off the bike. But that's the relationships are the things that stand the test of time. The results, they fade.
100%.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. So, you know, I'm looking forward to continue to building relationships. And I think it's what kind of keeps me in the sport beyond bike racing. You know, for me as a competitor, it's been really difficult to balance what I want out of my life without racing. You know, what do bikes mean to me now that, you know, I kind of set that path for so long, you know, just more than, you know, competitor for more than 10 years, you know, almost a decade and a half. And, you know, that some people have had a longer career than that for sure. But now, you know, never wanting to have stepped over the line of wanting to be on a bike, you know, for one reason or another, I did get to that point, you know, with injury and just pushing myself just way too far to keep up. Kind of reconnecting has been really difficult. You know, it's like you've had a power reader on your bike for 10 years, you just take it off one day and ride without it. Like,
yeah, you know, I hear that.
Some people might be able to do that, but old ADHD Hyde over here, no way. I'm just like, what am I doing right now? So I think like coaching has been a really cool way for me to continue to connect and to actually grow my my kind of community and to grow my impact. I think I feel like it's a better way for me to grow, or it's a better way for me to share and be impactful than bike racing was, you know. They just,
yeah,
you know, not that I kind of live and die by the, you know, you're only as good as your last race, but I think in terms of, I don't actually think it's a really bad phrase, but I do think that there are times when your relevance is much greater, right? And those things happen to, you know, coincide with results. Unless you're very, very good at social media.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a can of worms right there. And I just, that's never been, you know, I've never been able to sell myself to that degree and, or kind of stomach selling myself in that way. And so if my only real connection is through, you know, my relevance, and I can't be relevant by winning bike races anymore, you know, how do I do it? You know, that's always been a struggle, you know, but I think I found that path now through coaching.
So let's talk about retirement. I mean, you're already outlining some of the specific struggles with it. What has it been like for you transitioning out of the competitive racing scene?
Oof, challenge. It's been a real challenge. You know, for a lot of reasons. I mean, my last year of racing, I had a lot of injuries, and it was a real struggle because I've always looked at my career like I was kind of late to the game and I had so much to catch up on, et cetera. And when I'm just kind of riddled with injuries that kept me from doing what I wanted to do, it felt like I was falling more and more behind. When that last year of racing too, my wife and I had our child, Georgia, and that was a really big shift. A really big shift, and it was really difficult for me to just kind of balance being a parent, and being an athlete. And, you know, I think I kind of decided over that time that I don't think I can balance those things, not in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. And then just having all this energy and drive and then all of a sudden not having the outlet for it, was an unexpected difficulty in terms of like how to just kind of manage my expectations day to day and like also recalibrate what my priorities are. So one part of the process is that I went through the ADHD diagnosis kind of pathway, and that actually opened up an immense amount of tools and also relief for just like,
yeah,
okay, cool. Here are the things that like, this all makes sense. You know, this diagnosis totally jives with like how I've lived my life, every step of the way, and how I've used different things to self-medicate, you know, whether when I was like, younger, you know, before bike racing, whether it was like, you know, cigarettes, drugs, and alcohol. And then it was bike racing was just another way to kind of like, it was a great outlet. It was probably the most positive outlet I could do, but it was also a kind of untethered outlet. You know, it was just kind of like,
yeah,
unwieldy. It was just out there, you know, just spraying energy into the world.
Just going for it.
Just going for it, you know, with no clear end in sight, right? It's just the idea that there's some perfection on the other side, you know, that it'll be done whenever I reach this thing that I, you know, whatever. I think my personality and my kind of like, I guess my kind of neurodivergent nature led to that kind of, the combination of drive and lifestyle that is good for bike racing, you know, that kind of that monk lifestyle, right? It's very easy for me by nature to just have total tunnel vision all the time and to do things for me and to take, you know, every consideration for what I need and very little for other anything else, you know, whether it's my family, my immediate family, my extended family, my friends, anything like that. You know, I'm so capable of just putting blinders on and, you know, getting the job that I want to get done, and find it very, very difficult to do things that I don't want to do. And I know that's like, it sounds really easy for a lot of people to just be like, yeah, nobody wants to do hard things. But I think when you look at it from an ADHD perspective, you see these really large barriers, you know, these real, very real, you know, chemical barriers, you know, and all of a sudden you see, oh, okay, this is a common theme, you know, this isn't just me, you know, so then you get to kind of, you get to lose a little bit of the kind of, shame around it, you know,
big time.
And, you know, and you start to unpack it a little bit and you start to see like, oh, okay, other people have been successful with this. And
yeah,
the thing that I'm the most, you know, afraid of is like putting on those blinders and ignoring the world isn't bad. It's actually, my superpower, you know, it makes me absolutely capable of doing whatever I want to put my mind to. It's just that I have to figure out how to get my mind to want to do it. And those are the tools that I've just lacked for a really long time.
Thinking
of some people it's medication and some people it's just, you know, it's normal kind of tools, whether, you know, it's this writing things down so you remember them and keeping, you know, organization, et cetera.
Yeah.
I have found the most joy probably in my retirement in the last since getting that diagnosis, you know, just being able to pause and be able to kind of recognize when things are not okay with me and help finding the tools to help me get back on track, you know, or to even find a track. I mean, I'm just now getting to the point, you know, two years retired to where I'm putting a business plan together and thinking like, okay,
yeah,
I actually need to have a direction here. I can't just kind of float through this. And part of that was because I wanted time to just float and to see where I was, because that's how I got to where I am anyway. So
yeah,
I don't want to ignore that part of my life, but I also have a child and a wife and a house and all these things that like depend on me not just floating through the universe. if that's okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm kind of perpetually in the midst of finding that out, figuring that out, and, you know, being more stationary, being more, you know, physically located in an area is also difficult, you know, not being on the road constantly. You know, there's a lot of shifts.
Yeah. Well, the diagnosis thing really resonates with me because I similarly had a recent diagnosis of ADHD. And in my last year of racing, I got a really bad concussion. And as a part of the treatment for the concussion, they did a neuropsych evaluation just to see, make sure that I wasn't suffering from any cognitive effects of the concussion, right, which thankfully I was not. But I remember sitting down to do the assessment with the psychiatrist, and he was asking me about my history. And I joked to him that I've been self-medicating for undiagnosed ADD since I was in high school with high volumes of exercise. Yeah. And we both laughed about it. But then it came back on the evaluation that he's like, oh, remember when you were joking about that? No, you actually have that thing, like, very severely. And I had a similar sense of relief, because what it did for me was it made me realize that all of these things that I have long believed to be character flaws in myself, that I've just constantly struggled with and felt ashamed about, I can finally have stepped back and have this more, you know, like, meta perspective on it, and have compassion for myself that, you know, that, oh, this is harder for you. And not just in a, well, yeah, it's hard to do things you don't want to do kind of way, but in a, like, there are actual chemical, neurobiological reasons why you might physically feel paralyzed from getting up from a chair to do a simple task. Like, it's so much more severe than it sounds when you just say it like that. Kind of the release of moral judgment with the diagnosis was huge for me, because it was just kind of like, oh, and then, yeah, suddenly my whole life makes sense. You know,
right. Like,
oh.
Absolutely. 100%. You're just like, oh, yeah, yep, that checks out. Yep. Oh, that thing checks out. Yep, definitely. Yep. Okay, cool.
Yeah. And even your description of the blinders, it's, you know, that I think people think of attention deficit as like, oh, you have a hard time paying attention. Well, only selectively, but you also have this uncanny ability to hyper focus for extended, like, ridiculous amounts of time, which, to your point, is a superpower, because you can really go deep on learning new skills, becoming a phenomenal athlete, right? Like, these are things that serve us really well in some circumstances, but they are debilitating in others.
Absolutely. And I would recommend anyone who even remotely feels like they have a sense that they may have some form of ADHD or dyslexia or anything like that, to just, like, just do it. Just go in and find out. You know, I think it's a spectrum, right? And you look at where you land on it and how certain things affect your life. And then all of a sudden you just get all these tools. You know, I think it's not about medications for everybody. You know, I think some people, there's a really good use for medication. You look at that, say, like, okay, cool, you know, this is the one that works for you. I think especially with, you know, with athletes, like, hey, you want a real performance enhancing drug? Like, figure out how to harness yourself, and then figure out how to stop getting in your own way.
Yeah.
Like, you would be just an incredible athlete. I mean, imagine coming into the sport knowing what you know now. And just okay, cool, here's how I operate, and here's how I'm going to use this to my advantage.
Yeah.
Like,
well, because you spend so much time fighting your own wiring. And
100%.
When you understand how you're wired, then you can work with it in a way that's really constructive, versus constantly fighting with it, not getting results, and then judging yourself for it, right? The whole time.
Absolutely. And that's common with most athletes anyways. Like, that's it. That's right. That's the MO for a lot of people. It's just, like, constantly fighting themselves, blaming themselves for certain things, for not being other. They're not being this other thing, you know, this other picture of kind of greatness, when it really does come down to, like, hey, what are you going to be the best at? You know, what are your tools that you have to work with? Like, what are your strengths and what are your weaknesses? Not what is everyone else doing? And if you can look at it from an ADHD standpoint, you know, if you have that or you have symptoms of it, then, man, you just all of a sudden, right, like, you have this moral weight lifted off your shoulders where you're just like, I'm not a jerk that can't, like, return people's phone call. I'm not just an idiot for completely forgetting that I had to, like, sign this contract, but, like, you know, I just didn't set myself a reminder for it. And, like, that's all it takes sometimes. You know, I don't have the workflow to do this. And this gets along with this conversation that I have a lot with athletes of, like, okay, so where are you on the spectrum of athlete, right? Are you a beginner athlete? Is this something that you're just kind of entering? And then, like, that sets the tone for what kind of expectations you have and what kind of expectations I have as a coach. And then you have, like, the novice athlete. Is this just fun for you, but you already do it? Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Then you have, like, the elite level or the kind of pseudo elite level, where that could be a number of things. You know, that could be like I'm an elite racer that this is it for me. This is fantastic. I love doing this. I'm always going to be, you know, the local elite. This is great. Then there's like the elite with aspirations of professionalism, right? And then the professional, and or anywhere along that line, right? Where do you land on that spectrum? And if you kind of look at it as like a slider, you start to look at what different expectations that athlete should have both on themselves and, you know, on other people around them, right? And at some point on that spectrum, you start to look at the slider starts to hit the expectation of being more professional in what you do, because you have certain expectations, and the expectations might just be results-based, but if they're results-based, then you have to have a professionalism of like getting yourself to that point and just like making it consistent. Then if it's like be on a team, whether it's a local team or a local league team or a professional team, okay, there's the term professional because it's a job and there are expectations related to that job. And so like, where are you on the spectrum, and how do you incorporate being a professional? Because you can do a professional job without being a professional, right? Like you can do a good job and you can incorporate professionalism in what you do, and it'll only make you better with or without the title of being a professional. Professional just comes when you get your contract and you sign and you get some money. It's your job, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it. But how you act.
It's official. You're getting paid to ride.
100%. You're a professional. You're not an elite anymore. You're a professional. And
right.
And even then, you know, most people have to kind of figure out what they do that is professional and like how they need to be more professional and how they interact with that. And really good riders, often, you know, the best of the best of the best, figure out how to navigate professionalism. And often it's by virtue that they're a physiological outlier, and therefore things fall in around them. Then there are the kind of got to work hards, you know, of like, you're not a physiological outlier. You've got to work your way through it. You also have to dot your I's and cross your T's and become more professional because you lack this innate wild talent. That's where most people fall into it.
Yeah.
And I think with an athlete who can harness those traits, whether it's a quote negative or a quote positive trait, they can harness those things and they can learn to work with them to give themselves the tools to use them, and then also help their network, help them with it, you know, help them interact with it, then that's a level of professionalism that is really cool and should be kind of sought after. So
yeah,
you know, I can only see that an athlete with ADHD or any type of symptom from it that learns to harness that is just this next step up to becoming, you know, more professional. And it is really should be the primary focus, you know, until they kind of get that dialed, in my opinion.
I totally agree with that. I think a lot of people might be hesitant because they might worry, well, I don't, especially as a parent, you know, I don't want to label my kid, or even for themselves, like I don't want to put a label on myself. And then the worry being that if you label yourself with this, you know, diagnosis, then somehow that's going to affect or create some kind of a self-limiting belief. But I think that may have been the case, you know, decades ago when there was more stigma around it. But I think, number one, the more aware we are, to your point, you have tools. And once you understand how you work, you can work better. And then the more open we are about this stuff, the less stigma there is around it, which opens the opportunity for people to learn how they work and work more constructively and learn the tools that they need. Because if you just put blinders on and you continue to try to do things the way that, you know, if you're neurodivergent, you're trying to do things the way that neurotypical people do them, it might not work for you, or it might work, but at what cost?
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
That's definitely been one of the things that I've noticed is when I'm trying to do things, when I'm trying to like cram my neurobiology into a mold that it just doesn't fit, it is so taxing and draining. And that's where like my mental health really, really starts to suffer. And that's been a really important aspect of the diagnosis for me, is to learn that and to be able to like check that before it goes off the rails.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I've always had high anxiety, and I've never really been able to kind of pinpoint it. And, you know, I've always worked with a therapist to some degree, and I have for, you know, a long time. And one of the, you know, only after I retired bike racing, you know, did I realize that, like, oh, there's actually an order in which I function the best. You know, and you were saying how you kind of self-diagnosed or self-medicated with high volumes of exercise. But, like, that's a tool. That's actually a tool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where it fits in the sequence of what you do can be really beneficial. So if it's what takes up your whole day, that's where things start getting pushed down the line. That's where the things that you need to do start getting, like, kind of chopped here and there, and all of a sudden you build up this stress around these things that you need to do. And if the difficult, you know, a lot of times people say, like, oh, do the difficult thing first. Well, if I go, like, I really don't want to, like, clean my house today, but, like, I got to do it before I do my bike ride. Otherwise, like, the day is totally shot. Well, then I'll spend my entire day cleaning the house because I decided to do it. And now I'm so blinded by what I have to do that I'll spend 6 hours cleaning my house. I'm totally shot for my bike ride. Same thing with coaching. Like, I'll just go through and I'll open my computer and I'll just be on there until, like, oh my God, I have to go pick up my daughter. Like, I have to go to daycare. So I started putting it on a calendar of, like, aerobic exercise prior to doing my work. And what I found is that, like, cool, I do that. I have some food and I have a cup of coffee and I'm set. I'm ready. You know, I've thought through a lot of things. I'm able to get a lot of blood moving through my brain and I've got energy out. I move my body and now I can focus. I'm not rushing through things. I'm not clicking through tabs. I'm not opening stuff. I'm just doing my work, setting some timers and going, like, okay, cool, that's enough work. Now I'm going to go have a snack and then, like, putting on a schedule, like, Thursdays, clean my bathroom. You know, like, it's cool.
Yeah.
You know, and then all of a sudden you have time for stuff and that anxiety goes away.
Yeah. And it's just by figuring out the process that works for you. And with the knowledge of, okay, like, the exercise piece is really important for me because that is a component of the ADHD. And I, on the same neuropsych evaluation, the clinician actually noted ceiling levels. I say air quotes because it was an actual quote from the evaluation, ceiling levels of anxiety.
Oh, Lord.
And so I can really relate. And you know, when I was racing, I was working with a sports psychologist and I've long worked with a therapist and, you know, we kind of laughed about it, but I, upon reflection now and with the understanding of learning what ADHD is, how it works for me, and kind of figuring out my process too, I've recognized, I think most of that anxiety came as a byproduct of exactly what you're describing. Like, I'm trying to fit into a mold that doesn't work for me, and it's causing me anxiety because on some level it's not working for me. So I'm having to put in extra effort in order to achieve, you know, what in my mind is like an acceptable level of success. Right. And who knows where I get that, right? But so I'm, you know, I'm like,
that's a different podcast. I'm extending.
I know, right? Like, we'll have to schedule that one for later. But so there, it's just like, it's taking so much out of me. And at the same time, I feel like I'm constantly behind and I'm not getting done what I need to get done. And that anxiety was untenable, truly untenable. Yeah. And that's one of the things that, you know, again, just the relief, you know, releasing that self-judgment and learning, oh, okay, so this thing doesn't work for me and here's why.
Yeah.
And now that I know why, I can try this other thing and see how that works for me. And yeah, that's the working with versus the working against. It's just a total game changer.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what's interesting is I always push my athletes to seek some sort of, like, psychological support beyond me. Mm-hmm. And I've stopped, for the most part, asking my clients to look for a sports psychologist and just going straight to, like, clinical psychologist. Because I'm like, sports ain't the problem here, man. I'm like, you know, take it from me. It's just hard being a human. So, like, honestly, sports are the easy part. Like, being a person's hard. This is the easy part. And that's why we do it, to be honest. It's not because it's hard, because it's easy. Because it's what we're attracted to because we're, you know, good at it at some level. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that you said when we were exchanging emails prior to this was that elite athletes forget they are people with people problems too. So let's dig into that one a little bit.
Where do you want to start? Yeah, it's true. From the perspective of an athlete, you want to put these blinders on. You want to say, like, okay, here's my goal, and I'm just going to do everything it takes, and I'm going to just jettison everything in my life. But you don't. You don't jettison everything in your life. Your life is still there. It's in tandem. It's like riding around a tandem and, like, racing guns on the front and your life is on the back. And yeah. I think, like, you kind of have the choice, like, who's the stoker and who's the captain in that way. Racers choose to have racers be the captain and life be the stoker. And no matter how fast you go, it's still there. It's mm-hmm. absolutely still there. And to a degree, like, you need it to pedal. You absolutely need it to pedal. If you just expect it to just, like, sit there with its legs off, like, you're screwed. You're just dragging your life around. And if you work in tandem, if you help each other out in that way and you communicate and you have the same clear goals, then in sports just go so much better. And I think it's easy for an athlete to kind of look at their support network as purely athletic. And I think this is where I've seen the kind of delineation between a sports psychologist and a clinical psychologist, is that, like, okay, well, I'm an athlete and I have anxiety or whatever, so therefore I need a sports psychologist because I'm in sports. But that's probably not true. You're nervous about this stuff. It doesn't take a sports psychologist to tell you why you're nervous on the start line. Like, that's easy. Right. You're nervous because you want to do well. Sure. And there are a myriad of reasons, you know, why that kind of has crept up on you. And there's a myriad ways of tools to deal with that. It's important that you're nervous. It's a key to it. If you're not nervous,
you care.
And your heart and your body are reacting in the way that you want them to do, like going into alertness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I, for one, was the guy with the bike race around the front of the tandem and life with its feet off the pedals and, like, probably some extra life in, like, a bob trailer behind, just, like, also towing that. And I'm trying to climb up, like, the steepest mountain I can find. It's always going to come up to bite you, and it's always going to be the underlying issue. And so if you aren't taking care of your normal life, the relationships in it with your family or your partner or your friends, and you're just pushing those things aside all the time, your taxes.
Normal adult things. Yeah, exactly.
Even down to nutrition. I mean, we look at nutrition as this, like, end all be all in terms of, like, okay, I have to eat like a bike racer. And, like, yeah, you do, but you're also a person on the other end of this. And, you know, like,
yeah,
how many bike racers do I know that, you know, are now through bike racing having all these heart issues or endocrine issues or had to quit bike racing because of these issues? You do still have to be a person on the other end of this. You know, if you're lucky, if all kind of goes well, you do make it to the other side of bike racing, you know, alive, and you get to live, like, a normal life. But, like, you also need to kind of balance all those kind of former expectations of yourself.
Yeah.
I kind of say all that because I don't think you should wait until the racing's done to find the balance. I say this from experience. I don't say it because I did it right. I say it because I did it wrong.
Yep.
And I don't know the answer necessarily. I don't have the answer for it, except for what I have found is that with the people I do have interaction with, I can point out, like, hey, don't forget about this. Don't forget about this part. Right. And I was really lucky to have people like that in my life. Like, we were asking about a shout out. Brad Huff is, like, an example of this. And he's an incredible mentor to me in my bike racing career. But bike racing was such a small part of how it impacted my life. It still does. It's always been about being a good person and having a life, you know, and a good life that I wanted to live. And he found those experiences the hard way in a lot of ways. And, you know, some of it came easy to him still, right? Just like anybody.
Yeah.
But he was willing to share those things. And it made a really big impact on how I looked at my life. You know, like, okay, cool. This is a problem, but it's not the end of the world. This might seem huge, but it's not. Especially around injury. You know, I think he stepped into my life when I got really injured early on in my career. And he helped me first by helping me resolve the injury, by getting me to the people that could help, you know, by giving me a pathway. But bigger than that, he helped me because he taught me that this is part of your life now. Mm-hmm. This is your this is not an injury. This is like your child that you now have to care for and you have to deal with forever. You have to, you do have to nurture it, and you have to figure out how to live with it. You know, whether it goes away or it sticks around, whether you prevent it from happening again, you now have to expand your worldview here to include injury or depression or whatever it may be, so that you function on a normal working level before your athletics get the benefit of it. Does that make sense? You know what I'm saying?
That makes total sense. Yeah. I think athletes themselves believe that they can compartmentalize to the extent where they can just shut off life and say, okay, now I'm training or now I'm racing. And I think that people who look at athletes expect that of them, that they can shut off life and go and train and race. But the truth is, it doesn't matter how much you think you are compartmentalizing, what's happening in your relationships, what's happening with your financial security. I mean, just the basics of living life, those things deeply impact us in ways that we can't just shut off and put in a box and stick it on a shelf. I mean, to an extent, you have to do that temporarily in a bike race because you can't be, you know, you don't want to be thinking about what you're having for dinner when you're in the middle of the bike race, although how many of us do that? We do that. But like, you have to be able to focus, but that's very different. And when, for me, this all came to a head at one point in my career that led to like a really severe bout of overtraining, because I was only accounting for training stress when I was thinking about my recovery, and I wasn't thinking about life stress, because in my head, I thought I had separated them. And I thought that as long as I separated it in my mind, or I was telling myself they were separate, that they would be separate, but they weren't. And over a long period of time, that just built up because I had a lot of life stress that was piling on to the training stress. And I was only building in recovery in my training plan that accounted for the training stress. Right. And so I didn't have the emotional support, the recovery. I wasn't balancing that complete life allostatic load. I was only accounting for the training stress. And I learned that lesson the hard way. I mean, it was, it could have been career ending. It wasn't, thankfully, but yeah, it was really, really hard. And I remember at the time feeling somewhat disappointed in myself. Like, I should be able to handle all of this. If I were a better athlete, I could compartmentalize better. But going through that and coming out the other side of it, I realized that that wasn't realistic expectation of myself. Yeah. And I think that I was able to carry that lesson into the last maybe 4 or 5 years of my career, which, so I was fortunate for that, because I was able to start thinking about that in a different way.
Yeah, what a gift.
Not that it was easy, and even having that realization doesn't make it so that I could do it like that, right? It's sure. So much easier said than done.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. I mean, talk with athletes all the time about what does recovery look like? And I think, you know, you put an hour, hour and a half recovery ride on the schedule, which is a pretty standard deal, right? Okay, well, what's easy enough? And like, should I do it or not? It's like, cool, do you have stuff to do? Are you stressed out? Like, is this going to add stress to you? Like, don't do it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same thing with other things.
Yeah. Like,
you know, training's the same way. Like, you can say like, okay, this is the training that you need. In theory, this training should get you going in the right direction for what you want to do, you know, but if you're not taking your kind of external loads into that, then it really doesn't make any sense. It's why I don't necessarily use the metrics in like Training Peaks, for example, because A, there's never good enough data, and B, it leaves out 50% of what I need to know. And it's why I use comments and I use phone calls to really make decisions. You know, I ask athletes to make comments and, you know, use the little smiley face and frowny face and RPE thing. But then what I really make the decision off of is the conversation afterwards, where I ask them what they mean by it. And we put a better picture together. And it often changes the perception for both of us, right? I think that's where it kind of comes to, is like, your support network should help change your perception of what is going on, right? And like, with help you prioritize things, rather than just give you work.
Yeah.
But that's all we want as athletes, is like, just give me work to do. I'll do the work. I know you will.
That part's easy. Yeah. Just give me, Steven, just give me the perfect training plan that's going to make me the perfect athlete, and I'll do it. And we'll be good, right?
Yeah. You know, and I think this comes up to the overarching thing of like, everybody wants something to do. Nobody wants you to take something off the plate. That's a hard thing to get over too. It's just like, yeah, I know you're telling me that you can handle this other thing. I know you're telling me you need gym work. I know you're telling me you need this thing, but like, if you can't fit in a hour phone call a week with a, you know, clinical psychologist, then like, do you have more? Do you have the bandwidth for this? Like,
that is a really, really good point. And, you know, as you're describing that data that you can get, I mean, the data is so exciting and it's very powerful and we can get so much out of it. But I think it's so important not to forget the context of the data and what you're describing, listening to your athletes actually speak to you about what they mean about the comments, you know, two layers even removed from that, is it's not just about, you know, me being able to put out a certain wattage on one day is going to mean something really different than me putting out that exact same wattage in the exact same interval set on a different day, depending on, you know, am I sick? Is there something really stressful going on in my life? Am I just flying that day because I'm really excited about some other thing? I mean, the context matters so much.
A question I often ask is like, are you letting this happen to you in the way of like, you know, especially around races? Right? Like races are a really big one, especially like cyclocross races where just so many things can go wrong. And I often hear like, oh, well, so-and-so did this and then this happened and then this happened. And, okay, cool. So what did you do? Right? Like there's a big difference between being an active participant and what you're doing and being a passive participant. And it's the same thing with training. Like I went out and tried to do these intervals and like the first one sucked so bad, I just went home. Like, okay, did you try to bump the power down? Did you like, did you take a break? Did you assess? Like what did you do here? You know, did you just hammer through and it was just terrible? And how does that affect the rest of your day and everything moving forward?
Right.
When you're an active participant of things and you're empowered to do that as an athlete, then you get to help change the outcome of any given situation. And I think that's what I look for in like success in an athlete. When I look at an athlete and I think like, how have I helped them be successful? If they can make decisions on their own that have a positive impact on what they're doing. And if that's like just going home, if that's like, I tried these three things to like get this thing out of my head and I couldn't do it. And I just didn't want to do the intervals. Like, cool. Today's just not the day. Like that sounds right. Let's change things up. You know, there's no shame in that. This stuff happened. It sounds like this is something that we need to put some effort into. And where there's the ones that kind of power through everything and let what happens fall. You know, it's like, cool, is that productive or not? So if you can teach someone to, or yourself, to be an active participant in what you're doing and not necessarily let those things just happen to you and then that's the outcome, then, you know, your whole world changes in that way.
Yeah, I feel like there's two things that are so hard to learn and they're two sides of the same coin. One is, I don't know, when I got started, I felt like I could control pretty much everything, right? And if I just worked hard, then I would get results. And then you have that really tough life lesson of like, okay, I'm doing all of the things and, you know, it's not working out the way that it used to for me. Like why? And then you start to realize that, oh, there's actually a lot of things that are not within my control. And learning to accept that is really difficult. But then on the other side of the same coin is exactly what you're describing. Okay, yes, there are a lot of things that are beyond your control, but are you maybe over-defining that? Are there things that are perhaps within your control that you haven't taken the time to problem solve or be proactive about? And maybe success looks different than you think it does. And there's a different path that you can take. And man, that agency is so important.
Right. And I think it comes, I think there's one more question you have to ask when you get to that point of like, okay, I'm going to control all the controllables. Okay, cool. So you're willing to do that. You have the wherewithal to do it. Like you have figured out the pathways to control all these things. Like you're, you know, a resourceful athlete. Cool. Now, are you afraid to fail doing that? Like, are you scared of failing? Like, are you putting all this on the line? And like, if you fail, that's it? Because like the thing that we do the least amount of time in sports is win and be perfect. That's the thing that we do the absolute least, especially when it comes to competition. You know, you can be perfect in training, but that doesn't translate to racing. You can miss all sorts of things. So you need to be able to do all that and fail and come back to it and reassess and then come back and then fail or succeed and then have success and then fail, right? It has to be like failure has to be part of your process.
Yeah.
You have to kind of welcome it almost.
How did you figure out how to do that?
I think it took a long time, you know. I think I started to get to the point where failure wasn't really an option. You know, I think I was fortunate that I kind of really made my way through the ranks, and I kind of just by default of not even realizing I could do it, I kind of ran out every category of like, okay, I win. Okay, they kicked me out and I have to go back to this thing. And now I'm like driven to like do that, right? But then I got to the point where it was like, okay, I kind of ran out of steam with that, you know, domestically for a little while, where it was just like, I was just winning a lot of races and it was really cool. It was not a bad problem to have,
right.
But then I wasn't, and I still had the same mindset for whatever reasons, you know, injury and sickness and all these other things, you know, there was 2000, I think it's 2018. I won nationals in January. I won nationals again in December. So two times in 1 year. And then 2018, I went to Florida, did all this training in the summer, and it was like the hottest training I'd ever done. It was like August, July and August down there. And I just did so much training that I came into the season and I was like an absolute rocket ship. Like I was sharp. I was just so strong. I was like, I could go like top five in the like world championships with this fitness. Like this is unreal. I've never had this before in my life. I think I won every single race through the U.S. domestic season up until, you know, this is a pretty short period until, so like, you know, three or four, five races, weekends until, the first World Cup in Waterloo. Mm-hmm. And second or third, no, one, two, three, five turns in, around this off camber, Lars Vanderhaar like slides out in front of me. I hit him. I launch down like 10 feet down the track, down this hill, and I land on my back and I break my sternum. And that, like, breaking ribs sucks. It's like breaking all of your ribs at once when you break a sternum. It's like all of them. And there was nothing I could do about it. And it just took so long. And then I finally got back a little bit of shape. And I won the first day at Pan Am's, the you know, the C2 day at Pan Am's the day before. And I launched off the front for an attack in Pan Am's. And this is after like not even making podiums, and then I crashed, sprained my ankle, got a concussion, broke another rib.
Oh.
And from then on out, it was just really difficult to, I still had the same ideas of success in my head of like, okay, well, if I'm not winning a race, it's not success. Okay. But I like can't even get on a podium. I can like, I'm barely top 10-ing these races right now. Cause I went from owning all the points to not getting any points. But I didn't break that mindset of win at all costs kind of scenario. And so I think it was helpful to have somebody, my coach, you know, just say like, look, that's not you anymore. It may never be you again. Potentially, you have to make a choice of like, do you accept where you're at and slow down and focus on recovery as opposed to getting directly back to where you were, or do you just take some time with this and you just accept where you're at and just see it as the process and just say like, hard stop, reassess, here you are. Now, take all those things that you made you successful in the first place and then reapply them here. You're just moving the goalposts a little bit. The idea that you've already been there, right? The fact that you've already been there means that in theory, you have a shorter path to get back to that point if you are, you know, successful in how you do this.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you've learned all those lessons. But
yeah,
I think it's difficult for someone who has been at that level to be able to break that mindset and just take the bit out of their teeth and just for a second and relax and let themselves heal. And
yeah.
Yeah. And so even in my last year of racing, I was so unhappy with my results. You know, I was able to come back. I won nationals that year. I barely did any racing and so on by just pure determination. I won nationals that year, but you know, that was kind of the last one. And my results went downhill from there. And a lot of it was just because like every hit was so much more psychologically damaging to me because I just wouldn't let that go.
Yeah.
That I really wish that I could have let that go in the time that I had.
Yeah, that's a really, really tough one. And I think that there's so much that comes with that. When I had that concussion, I worked with a specialist who, he works with a lot of athletes. Like he works with the Yankees and like the pro rodeo circuit. And so he has seen some serious stuff and he's used to dealing with an athlete mentality. Yeah. A lot of smashed heads. And one of the things he told me at the beginning, which really struck me, was he said the hardest thing to heal about a concussion is the PTSD. And I was like, what? Like, yeah. I mean, I fell off my bike and I fell off my bike. I mean, where's the PTSD in that? And he was like, no, it was a trauma. That was a legitimate trauma. And I kind of stopped and I started, you know, doing the rewind tape, you know, like record scratch, rewind, and then like the montage of my whole career flashed before my eyes. And I thought, okay, if that was trauma, then what about this whole, this whole 12 years of all of this other stuff? And what I realized was I ended up retiring that year, not the concussion sort of was, I had planned on retiring that season. The concussion sort of accelerated that timeline, but I started to work with my therapist specifically on the PTSD component, which was super interesting. And I'm so grateful that that actually happened because I think it helped me process something that I would have just carried with me into the next chapter if I hadn't had that like hard stop that said, okay, let's sit down and like really confront and deal with this. And I think when I look back on my career now with the understanding that I have now, I can see how every injury, every setback kind of started to chip away because it wasn't just about processing the trauma. I think that was part of it. But it just started to accumulate in a way because whether I was processing the trauma or not, or even just the psychological fallout of, you know, your body not doing what you want it to do and not, you know, you're doing the same things that you used to do that used to get you results and used to get you race wins, and it's not working anymore. And it erodes your confidence and it erodes a sense of, I don't know, it erodes agency and a sense of self in a way that is really, really hard to come back from. Just really hard to come back from. Not impossible, but it takes so much focused work to do that, that when you're in the middle of a career like that, it just doesn't feel like you have the time to devote to that kind of work. Nor would you even necessarily know that that's something that you might want to do.
Absolutely. I mean, you're getting at the idea that we're so tied up in our athletics and our self-worth are so tied together that they're inseparable to a degree. And I think this is where being a human and a bike racer at the same time have to exist well, because it's okay and probably a good thing to want to succeed at what you want to do, right? It's a very good thing. Mm-hmm. But is doing good at something what makes you who you are? Or is it just a trait, you know, is it just part of who you are? Mm-hmm. And I think for me, it was really difficult to detangle those two things because I didn't have a life outside of bike racing. That was it. I devoted everything to it. And therefore, it's a really tricky thing to navigate when you do have an athlete that just wants bike racing, that just wants to be a good bike racer. Okay, cool. Well, you have to know that this is going to end.
Yeah.
The reason why those who do really well and end on their own terms are legends is because there's very few of them.
Yes.
And the likelihood it's going to be you is, sorry, small.
Very small. Very small.
Yeah. And even those people struggle, you know, struggle with self-worth. Yeah. Everybody struggles with self-worth when they kind of come down to it. I mean, it's just such a rare example of an athlete that does so well and then steps away from it to go do something else because that's, you know, that's the real thing. That's the real passion.
Yeah.
It exists, but it's very rare. So yeah, an injury like that, a TBI or life-altering injury, challenges your perception of your self-worth. It all of a sudden takes away your ability and your agency and how you build your self-worth, how you put yourself out there with other people, you know, what makes you, quote, good in other people's eyes.
Steven, time has absolutely flown by. I mean, I've got more notes here, and I don't know. I think we need to do like 3 more episodes together if you're up for it.
I'm down. You got me.
This has been so much fun, Steven. Thank you very much for taking the time today. I think people are going to get so much out of this conversation and your insights.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I really appreciate it. I love these long form conversations, and I've always loved the conversations that you and I have had in general. So I was excited to get the message, and I'm happy to be on anytime. Yeah.
Oh, likewise, and thank you so much, Stephen. I had so much fun talking about all of this with Stephen. I especially love his take on leading not with ego, but with heart and connection, even when it comes to high-stakes competitive arenas. While these are things I often strive to do myself, this conversation with Stephen left me feeling even more inspired to proactively build relationships and community. I hope you feel empowered to step into your own agency and prioritize connection in your life as well. Thank you for joining us for today's episode. If you loved today's show, remember to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review. The Be a Good Wheel podcast is produced by our wizard behind the curtain, Maxine Philavong. Find all published episodes and sign up for our newsletter at beagoodwheel.com. You can also listen wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the show comes entirely from listeners like you. Support us on Ko-Fi and Patreon to get monthly Q&A episodes, official Be a Good Wheel merch, and more. You can submit questions for Q&A episodes at beagoodwheel.com. We encourage you to check out our page on Ko-Fi. Unlike Patreon, Ko-Fi doesn't take a fee, so 100% of your support goes to the show. Go to ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. That's ko-fi.com, ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. Learn more about how to support us at beagoodwheel.com/support. Until next time, thanks for listening, and thanks for being a good wheel.